Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I do have a comment today, and I really appreciate getting comments, and thank you for turning this one in. But it says, "Hello, JBL. I have read several of JBL's books, and I have to say, Hero is one of your best. I view Ned's exploits as a pedagogy that show God's hand using men and how important character and courage are to God. Surely, Ned's willingness to go into battles is a reflection of how I must have that same character to go into battle, to take the kingdom by force." And so he sees a real spiritual side to Hero, and of course, I think we did as well. So I appreciate that comment. Now, on our last program, we did complete our discussion of Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. It was a long series, but I really believe it was an important one. Now, this book gives us great insight into the causes behind today's troubled Middle East. And if you are turning to JBL just for the first time now, you can go back and listen to this series at SoundCloud or at the trumpet.com website. And I believe it will be well worth your effort. Now, today we are going to begin a new series of reading a different style of literature called the essay. And basically, there are four different types of essays. And we'll talk briefly about them just right now. There's the probably the most common essay are narrative essays. That's where you're telling a story. And the second kind of essay is a descriptive essay. It's like painting a picture. A third type of essay are expository essays, where they just give just the facts. And then the fourth kind of essay is a persuasive essay. Now, the book we're going to be reading is titled Things That Matter. And what it is, it's a collection of Charles Krauthammer's essays. And as we go through these programs, we'll talk about these different aspects. And in some ways, he uses all four of these in his essays. He kind of combines them in a unique style. And we're going to be talking about these styles as we go along. But I think primarily he stays in the expository essays genre. He gives us a lot of facts. He uses those facts to prove his points. But then always at the end of his essay, he has this little zinger that wants to convince us that we need to think of things the way he does. So anyway, we will talk about these things more. But this is a little bit of a different kind of book, but I think you're going to find it, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be humorous, but it's also really a lot of fun. And so today, what I want to do, though, for this program is just to discuss the man, Charles Krauthammer. Now, those of us here at kpcg.fm, those of us that teach here at the college, those of us that write for trumpet.com and also for the Philadelphia Trumpet, we have really valued his essays, and we've quoted from him an awful lot. Now, he died on June 28, 2018, from a fast-acting cancer. But he had lived a productive life, and it was full of accomplishments. And it's really well worth studying him and to study the way he thinks. So I've invited a special guest in here today to help me do this. And it is my companion in literature and my dedicated wife, Deborah. So welcome back to JBL.
Thank you. It's good to be back again.
Yeah, you've had this long vacation.
Yes, that's right.
It's time you get back to work.
That's right.
So let's just start talking about Mr. Charles Krauthammer. And maybe we could talk about his education. I'll let you go ahead and start off since you've been off the radio for a while.
Yes, well, it's interesting to see where he came from. He actually lived in Canada, and he went to McGill University. and he was actually French speaking. And there was one little story where I thought was funny. I forget where it was, one of those little somewhere in the introduction where he talks this interested me because I do know a little bit of French.
Yes,
but
she's actually fluent. She just doesn't want to admit it.
Well, I was, yeah. But anyway, he was speaking what they call Parisian French, but I don't know who he
grew up in Montreal.
I believe it was Montreal. Yeah. Yes, that he got on the bus and spoke in perfect Parisian French. And this little boy, and they looked at him, you know, they didn't appreciate it at all because they speak a different kind of French. And so he learned
you know that as well.
Yes, he learned not to speak with the proper Parisian French. But anyway, he went to McGill University and actually gets started. That's where he first wrote a kind of a political piece, a kind of a journalism piece. That was the first time he actually wrote something.
Yeah, but that was because he was the senior editor for the school magazine.
Yes, right.
So it was like
an accident that he got into it, yes.
Right. Maybe we ought to just say that McGill University is in Montreal, Canada.
Yes.
Now, maybe I could add a little other detail there is that he was actually born in New York.
Okay.
And so then his parents, they moved to Montreal, and so then he actually has dual citizenship, or he had dual citizenship. He was actually American and Canadian, so he lived there. And that's, of course, going to McGill, he was in Quebec, and so that was obviously a French province. So the McGill University is really a top university in the world, and a lot of your, let's say for us, foreign diplomats have gone to school there. And So you can see why he knew French. But I think it's interesting that I guess maybe it shouldn't be overly interesting that he was taught Parisian French at the high-level college. You know, it was a university level. So he wasn't like the little French kids that grew up in Quebec and the Canadian French. And, of course, I know that you've been taught Parisian French, and we've actually traveled through those provinces, and it's really hard to understand the Canadian French when you know the Parisian French. So he did a good job at it. I think what's really funny is, Brett Baer talks about him, and especially after he died, because he was Fox commentator for him, but he said that he used to talk to himself in French. So that when he was getting ready for the program, he'd be mumbling things in French that no one else could understand.
Oh, I didn't know
him.
That's funny.
Yeah, so that's really kind of interesting.
See, because he grew up because his parents were French, you know, so that's where he learned French.
All right. So let's continue there. So he went to McGill University, and again, that is a big research university in Montreal and has a lot to do with politics. And so there he did. He did write his first political essay there. And, of course, we can talk a little bit about that more later. Let's also go the next university he went to, I think it's Balliol College in Oxford. That's England. And so there he actually got a degree, or he was studying politics in Oxford. And he's considered a Commonwealth Scholar in politics from there. So I think that's really quite interesting. But then I was surprised to learn about him that he also then came back to the States and went to Harvard Medical School. And he graduated with a degree in medicine.
I know, that's amazing. We would never have known that. No.
No.
Yes.
And so he talks about this obviously in the introduction to his book. And so the thing is eventually he came back to really just politics and wanting to write on politics. But on page 9, I think it's kind of, if I have the right thing there, page 8 and 9, he says, medicine had not been my first choice. I had long preferred the graceful lines of physics to the ragged edges of biology. But at 16, I'd come to the realization that I didn't have what it took to do important work in theoretical physics, namely, genius. A friend of mine in special relativity class who had come to the same awful conclusion about his own intellectual capacities told me that he was changing his major because he didn't want to end up testing steel for General Motors. So anyway, I think he's being very humble there. I think he certainly was a political genius.
Yes, he certainly was a genius. So, yes, he certainly had a mind.
But I think it's interesting that when he went to medical school, he was actually studying psychiatry as well. And this is on the middle of page 9. And, of course, one of the things when you get into medical school, you have to do what the head of the medical school tells you to do. And he was supposed to go I'll just read this. He says he went to Massachusetts General for his training. And he says, I discovered that all freshman students were required to attend a weekly group therapy session. Seeing this as pointless, I refused. This did not go over well with management. Around week 7, I was called into the department chairman's office. He asked me why I had not been attending. And, of course, his answer was, because I came here to give therapy, not to get it, I said. He said, you're just in denial, he protested loudly. Of course I am, sir. It's the best defense mechanism ever invented. Why, I'm a master of denial. I should be a professor. I could give a course in denial. So he's pretty bold, maybe he's not so bold, but he was very educated, I can say it that way. He said, I was enjoying the riff, but the chief was not. He cut me short, attend the sessions or leave the program. Having a few marketable skills and fewer prospects, I attended. But for the remaining 20 or so weeks, I said nary a word in the group. I was occasionally asked why. He goes on to say, I'm in denial, I explained. So I think that's really, he seems like he was just a really well-rounded, humorous, really smart guy.
Yes, and willing to push the limits a little bit, too.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. He got that at McGill, I'm sure, studying politics. All right. Let's talk briefly now about his accomplishments. And then we can then get into some other things related to Mr. Krauthammer. So, he talks just briefly about himself in this introduction. I think one of his great accomplishments was his extensive education. I mean, that's a lot of time in school. So if you look at 7 years of medical school, probably he spent 4 years at McGill, probably 4 years at Oxford. That's a lot of schooling.
Yes, it really is. Yes.
I know. I was sick of when I did my master's. I was really sick of it by then. Of course, you know that we were married by then, and you were sick of me going to school too, because you were typing all my papers, and pregnant with our first child. So anyway, I think that is a real tribute to him that he got all of that education, and of course, there's something even more. I think specific about him that we'll talk about here in a few minutes. So after he got his medical degree in psychology, then he goes on to say that he became head of the super agency over the National Institute of Mental Health in Washington, D.C., and President Carter appointed him as that. So that's really kind of a significant achievement. To be over the super agency.
Yeah, super agency that was overseeing it. Yes, that's interesting. It seems like they all have lots of agencies, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
The government.
They do. Yeah, they were talking about that a little bit last night on Fox News. All the, intelligence agencies. There's like a billion of them.
Yes.
And they're all watching each other, including President Trump, So you can see where the government has just continued to expand. But then also at that time, I think he got the hankering to get out of maybe medicine, and then he began writing for the New Republic. And so he did want to go back to politics, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But then I think it's also interesting that after writing for the New Republic, which is a pretty famous magazine, then he became a speechwriter for Walter Mondale. And, of course, I remember the Walter Mondale days. I think it was probably one of the one of the first elections I was able to vote in, you know, and of course he didn't win, you know, so anyway, but he still was writing for him. And then, of course, then he got the job at the Washington Post. And then he became commentator for Fox News, and he was with Bret Baier for years. And so when he died in 2018, it was a big loss. And I know, you know, there's a lot of people that you know, have been deeply saddened, you know, by that. But maybe we could spend some time talking about, let's say, I think his most important achievement. And that was overcoming his horrible accident.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting is in this introduction where he gives a little biography, he doesn't mention the accident at all. I mean, I think in a lot of his writing, and it seems like in his life, he never draws attention. He doesn't draw attention to the fact that he was paralyzed. He was very much disabled. It's kind of it's amazing.
From the neck down.
From the neck down. It's amazing what all he accomplished. And he accomplished it after he had the accident. He had the accident during medical school, and he was still able to complete medical school. And I think that's just amazing.
Yeah, so I think he was 22 when the accident happened. And, of course, it was a diving accident into a swimming pool where he broke his neck.
Yes, right.
So all those things are really, really kind of tragic when they happen. But he does talk about his accident in a backhanded way in one of his essays in the book. And this is why this book, I think, all of you listeners out there, it really is a fascinating book. And it's easy reading. I mean, Michael Korda's book was more of a challenge. And just to keep all the facts and all the history and, you know, everything together. But this book is really a delight to read. And he does talk about, I'd say one of his professors, but also a very good friend of here, is in an essay. And it's on page 34 of the book. Now, maybe to just mention to everybody out there listening, we're going to be skipping around in the book quite a bit. And then I'm also going to be inviting a lot of different guests on to discuss these essays. And we may not get through every one, but certainly, you know, you could take the time and read it. It's a book where you can just keep it by your television seat or your, you know, keep it on your desk. And then every now and then when you have a few minutes, you know, there's not many. They're not more than, at least I haven't seen many of the essays more than 3 or 4 pages. Some of them are just really short, but they're really, it's really great reading, but it also reveals what a great mind he had. And so this essay on page 34 is called Herman Lisco, Man for All Seasons. And essentially, you know, what he talks about is this was, you know, he calls him a gifted scientist. He was a legendary teacher. And he wrote this essay for him when he died. And I'll just maybe start out with by reading the first paragraph of it. Again, this is page 34, not 43. I've got number dyslexia. Sorry about that. But here he goes on. He says, Herman Lisco, a gifted scientist and legendary teacher, died last week. He was a quiet man from an unquiet place, German-born. He received his medical degree from the University of Berlin in 1936, came to the United States to teach pathology at John Hopkins University, and was recruited to the Manhattan Project in secret. He worked with a team of scientists at the University of Chicago studying the biological effects of a strange new human creation, plutonium. And so that even rings with me, because for years I worked at the Hanford Project, which was part of that Manhattan Project when we were developing the first, you know, atomic bomb. It says, later he was flown to Los Alamos to study the first person to be killed by an acute radiation poisoning. Lisco performed the autopsy and later those of 8 other victims of accidents at Los Alamos. And, of course, we've been to New Mexico many times, although we've never actually gone to the Los Alamos site. His findings were a scientific milestone, the first published account of the effects of acute radiation exposure on the human organism. A decade later, he was instrumental in producing a landmark United Nations report on the effects of radiation on humans and on the environment. But Dr. Liskow was more than a scientist. At Harvard Medical School, where he subsequently became a professor, he was the most beloved and influential mentor of an entire generation of students. So it's by this third paragraph that we finally learn the connection between Liskow and Krautheimer. So obviously, he was one of his professors at the medical school.
Yes.
So you can go on now if you want to take over and talk about it a little bit. So.
Well, he goes on to explain the connection. He said on page 35, "As for me, well, he made my career possible. Toward the end of my freshman year, I was paralyzed in a serious accident. Hermann, then Associate Dean of Students, came to see me in intensive care. He asked what he could do for me. I told him that to keep disaster from turning into ruin, I had decided to stay in school and with my class." So that's just amazing because he still wanted to keep on going. You know, most people would just give up,
right,
but he wanted to keep going. So he says it. So in other words, Hermann Liskow became his partner in crime in some ways. He wanted to help him with this.
Right. I think it's funny is it's not Hermann that went to him and said, "You need to finish medical school."
No. He said he wanted to, but Hermann did say, "What can I do to help?" Which is nice.
Well, but then he's so obviously. I mean, if you're paralyzed and you're laying there, he's obviously thinking about these things. You know, what am I going to do with my life?
Right.
And you know, I had just a minor similar experience when I had that bicycle accident, and when the hospital gave me that stroke. You know, but thankfully I've been brought out of all that. But, you know, he obviously was thinking about it. So I think it just – I think he's talking about the value of Hermann, but I think we have to read between the lines and see how in his personality he wasn't going to let anything stop him.
Right, right.
Yeah. So go on then.
And he just said that he would do everything he could to help him. And it says, this is really funny, he says, "Within a few days, a hematology professor fresh from lecturing to my classmates on campus showed up at my bedside and proceeded to give me the lecture while projecting his slides on the ceiling above me. I was flat in my back in traction, but I'm sure Hermann had instructed everybody to carry on as if such teaching techniques were entirely normal." It's just so funny the way he talks about it. So then he keeps talking about he went on to work behind the scenes, persuading professors to let me take their test orally with a reading secretary. I did not learn to handwrite for another 3 years. So here he couldn't even write.
Right, right.
So he was doing everything orally. It's just amazing. And then
so he
says,
had to keep all these facts in his mind.
Yeah, so he didn't write anything down.
Yeah.
That's true. He wasn't taking notes. He couldn't do that. Then it says... And then eventually he got Hermann transferred him to 12 months of inpatient rehab at a Harvard teaching hospital so that I could catch up at night with my class of second year studies and rejoin it in the third year. And then he said persuading or ordering skeptical attending physicians to allow their patients to be cared for by the student in the wheelchair with the exotic medical instruments. The extra long stethoscope Hermann had made for me was a thing of beauty.
Yeah.
The way he describes it, it's really funny but he has a good way of describing these things in just a few words. So you can just picture him in a wheelchair with his long stethoscope and he's a student, you know, checking up on patients and they allowed him to do that. So, and then it says, Hermann did all this quietly without fanfare. At graduation, he took not only pride, but a kind of mischievous delight in our unspoken conspiracy. We broke no rules, but we bent a few, especially the stupid ones. I'm sure he liked that.
Yeah. So it really, it is amazing how, you know, in here in Krautheimer's life, he, you know, I always believe that you know, for people that God wants to use, and of course, I mean, Krautheimer was not converted that we know, and you know, but it seemed like there's a lot of the way he thought that we could use, you know, to help us in our work, and you know, but it seemed like what he needed was Hermann. Mm-hmm. And then Hermann was right there and helped him get through it. It's just amazing. So many people would just give up, and he didn't. But then he also goes, I thought it's interesting, he talks about that Hermann himself was a little bit of a radical, and that he resisted the Nazis. He married a Jewish woman. It says defiance ran in the family. Hermann's father was fired as head of Gothenburg's elite high school for his opposition to the Nazi regime. And, I think this is what I really like, is Hermann did not much respect nature's strictures either. At 70, he was still climbing mountains in his beloved Adirondacks. At 80, he was still taking miles-long walks in the woods. And now, just short of 90, he's gone. Maybe as we go through the series, I'll read you the touching last article he wrote about his own death. This is Charles Krauthammer. Surprisingly, or we should not be surprised, this is all the time we have for today's program. So we have begun our new series titled A Tribute to Charles Krauthammer. And, of course, we are reading selected portions of his book of essays titled Things That Matter. Now, you can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. Streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.